Normally I give slide presentations at conferences, but because this is a tutorial, I decided to go back to my roots and give a Blackboard talk so that y'all can take notes. I'm from Texas. I will say y'all. You can laugh if you want.
Will you post your notes on the web?
They're maybe not neat enough yet. If I have time to read, write them or type them, but I wouldn't count on it. So the first of the three lectures is going to be background on sparse approximation. Just to give you some motivation for why people started studying these problems and some of the basic mathematical framework that people use to talk about sparsity, the approximation problems with sparsity constraints. Okay. So the original motivation for this goes back a long way, certainly at least 50 years, but probably 70 or 80. And it comes from the statistics community. And the problem is called variable selection in linear regression. So here's the idea. We're going to let x and y1, y2, up to yn be random variables. And our goal is to cook up a collection of real coefficients C1 through Cn, so that we can predict x as a linear combination of the random variables y with the weights c. Okay. So if we observe these variables y, we want to be able to combine them to get a prediction for the variable x. Basic problem. And one of the classical examples is where x is a student's GPA or grade point at the end of his freshman year. And so you might like to predict this based on data you have at the beginning of the freshman year, or you know, after a few weeks of the semester. So maybe you have SAT math scores, so a standardized test. Maybe you have the student's SAT verbal score. Maybe you've got the student's parents' income. Perhaps the number of binges first month of college. I teach at the University of Michigan, so. Well, you teach at Duke.
Still doesn't matter.
That was my point. Hey, I'm gonna leave that alone. Okay. So these actually might all be relevant. And you might be able to give a student a questionnaire at the beginning of the semester, or collect data from their admissions application and so forth. And you'd like to see how they're doing at the end of the year so that you can perform an intervention if necessary, or you know, nominate for scholarships or whatever. Okay. So the way that people often go about this is to start out with some measured data. So you're going to design this estimator. So this thing here is an estimator for this random variable. It's also called a linear predictor because it is a linear combination of the variables. And the idea is you might like to design this estimator from data that you've collected. So here's how that might work. You've got some collection of students for whom you've got detailed information. So for the first student, you have the value of the first random variable, the second random variable, and so forth, on up to the nth random variable. So you've got all their SAT math scores tabulated. For the second student, you have all of their scores tabulated, their input, and so forth. And this continues down to the dth student. So for each of these students, you've got the values of all of these random variables. And you've got these unknown coefficients here that you're looking for. And you'd like this to be approximately equal to the values of their GPAs at the end of the year. So using information from this year, we'll try and develop a predictor we can use for next year. So here are the D students again, here are the D students, and here are the variables we have for each one. And so we'd like to solve this linear system or find an approximate solution in case the equations are inconsistent or don't span the entire space or something like that. Okay, so we can write this in more compact form. As phi times c is about equal to this vector x. So phi is the matrix, c is the vector of coefficients, x is the vector of unknowns here. Now, a classical approach to solving the problem is use least squares. This goes back to Gauss. But typically what we're going to do is add some regularization. So a classical approach is regularized least squares. And here's the optimization problem that would be attached to that. So you want to minimize over all sets of coefficients the squared prediction error. So we...
You're assuming there are less students than...
I'm getting there. Okay, so I'm actually not making an assumption about this. So what you'll try to do is minimize the prediction error plus some weight times the sum of the squares of the coefficients. Okay, so these two terms here have different sort of intuitive effects. So the first one here is minimizing the bias of the estimator. You want to make the prediction error as small as you can on the data that you have. And this term here is trying to control the variance of the estimator. So phi times c is a random variable. You'd like it to be have average value as close as possible to x. And you don't want it to spread around a lot. So you'd like the variance to be small. And so this is sort of a surrogate for making the variance low. Now, the major advantage of this kind of problem is that it's analytically tractable. So you can solve this using standard algorithms for numerical linear algebra. You can compute the singular value decomposition of the matrix and shift the singular values by a small amount and write down a formula in terms of the singular values and singular vectors for the solution. So that's good. But there's some serious problems with this approach. And let me try and explain why people don't like to do this. So one sort of conceptual reason is that the predictor
probably uses all of the variables.
Okay, there's some geometric reasons for this that I'm not going to go into, but it's very likely when you solve a least squares problem like this that the coefficient vector C that you obtain is dense. All of the entries are non-zero. And so what that means is that you're writing the right-hand side here is a linear combination of all of the columns. Okay. And there's some practical issues here. So you might not want to measure all of those variables. I mean, if you're a freshman, you're not going to fill out a survey with 100 questions on it. You have to go back to your binge drinking. It's better to get surveys with fewer questions. It might be very expensive to collect data, which is certainly true in a lot of the sciences. You have to pay for that. You don't want to pay for it. So there are some practical reasons that you really want to use few variables for your predictor. And there's some technical reasons as well. So the predictor probably has too many degrees of freedom. I'll draw you a picture to explain this in a moment. So it explains noise. So here's the way you could sort of look at this. If you've got just two variables here, and you're trying to predict one as a linear function of the other, and your data looks like this, so here's y, here's x, and you want to write x is about equal to a plus by. What you can see here is that this really has a sort of straight line sort of trend. And so you'd really like to predict it with one variable. But on the other hand, let's say that you've collected 200 different variables y. You don't want to write x as a plus by1 plus cy2 and so forth with some huge number of terms when the data really exhibits a linear trend. So the trouble is if you've collected too many variables and you develop a predictor of this form, it may involve all of the variables, even when you only want to use one variable to explain what's actually happening. So if you fit a high-degree polynomial to this, for example, it might actually hit every one of those data points. But which one of these is a better predictor in your view? Not the high-degree polynomial. So, this is one reason.
Is that peculiar to L2?
L2?
That's more of setting up the problem. Mm-hmm. If you have that problem, is that an error that's peculiar to L2?
L2 is particularly bad in this case, yes. I'm just sort of trying to motivate why it is that you're interested in sparsity in this problem. So, there's one other technical reason here. And that's that the predictor has high variance. And this is a problem that is especially grim with L2 regularization. The basic reason is that if you have independent random variables, their variances sum. Okay? So every time you add a new random variable into your predictor, its variance gets bigger. Okay? And so you don't want that to happen. Like I said, you want it to be on target, you want the bias to be low, but you don't want it to wiggle around a lot. And that's sort of the fundamental problem with this high-degree polynomial fit. It's on target, it hits all the data points, but it wiggles a lot. And so if you start trying to predict something else, it may do an atrocious job. Okay, so...
How about for the second problem, if you make the problem underdetermined, like just use mm-hmm. C1, C2, nothing else. Mm-hmm.
But if you've collected 200 variables, how do you know which ones to use? That's exactly the point. So, the goal here, find a small subset of variables for the predictor. Okay. So what you would like to do here is say, well, I collected all of these things in my data, but the actual explanation doesn't involve all of them. I'd like to identify that this variable and this variable are the important ones and leave out the rest. Okay? So I'm trying to find a smaller model. Yes?
So in the interest of, you know, launching some elementary questions, so a critique one could make of the way this is set up at present is that there's no normalization of the variables.
That's right.
That is, for example, most universities, I'd like to think that the SAT math score and the number of binges in the first month are not the same order of magnitude. For that matter, the parent's income could be reported in dollars or reported in cents. And of course, that would change, see that constant by an order of magnitude.
That's right.
So,
yeah.
Presumably, you would want to normalize these to have
standard
deviation one. Is that?
Yeah, that's exactly correct.
And be independent, or at least then the.
You can't do anything about that.
Well,
you
can make your L2 be a dot product using covariance, right? Instead of.
Yes, you can try to do that. Is there another question?
Okay, so let's say that you do that, so you normalize them.
Mm-hmm.
Now going on to problem number three, the fact that the literature tends to have high variance. So if you look at what it is that you're trying to minimize, then essentially what that tells you is that there's a certain scaling that you'd want to adopt for lambda.
Yeah, that's right.
Right? And so is the point that with that scaling, then you do a ridiculously bad job of minimizing the bias? I mean, you have
so there's a knot here. There's always a bias variance trade-off. What people usually do to identify lambda, the regularization parameter, is to solve the problem with a whole bunch of different values of lambda and then try out the predictors on a holdout set. So they collect additional data. So that's sort of a statistics issue. But people will, there's some statistical methods for ascertaining what lambda is best.
But what I'm thinking is that if lambda scales as, I mean, if lambda is a constant and it doesn't, scale as, like order n or something like that, then when you're minimizing that, what that says is that the variance term is going to dominate in that minimization, right?
Yeah. Well, that's sort of the purpose. You can sort of decide how to tune the knob, whether you prefer low bias or low variance. But of course, this is just a surrogate for the variance. And you're really better off by trying to limit the number of variables that participate.
I agree. I'm just trying to figure out what happens if you would just go ahead and kind of blindly do that. I mean, you sort of identify these three problems. And it seems to me that actually what would happen is not so much, the problem wouldn't be so much that it has a high variance, because, I mean, you would solve that problem by minimizing.
You're going to pay somewhere. That's basically the issue. I mean, even if you manage to get the variance low, the bias is going to be awful. I'll take more questions in a sec, but I do want to say that this is really just motivational. This is the classical problem where people are trying to perform sparse approximation, and so the details are not really very relevant to the rest of the lecture. I'm just trying to make it clear that there are some natural cases that arise in applications all over the sciences where you need to solve this problem. Okay. Yeah.
I'm a little confused about the use of language, which is on the same point. There you said the intuition for the C22 term was variance control, and then you just jumped right back and said, oh, we have a problem with variance.
Yeah, that's
well, right. What do you mean by control exactly?
I mean control a little bit loosely, but this is sort of a surrogate for the variance. It's not the actual variance. And so as Mark pointed out, you could try and put the covariance matrix in here and control it a little bit more directly. But if you really want to get the variance down, you really actually need to throw out some of the variables. But again, let me try to move on, because I just want to motivate for you that this is a fundamental problem where you need to find a solution to a linear system that doesn't involve too many columns of the matrix. Is that point clear? So we're trying to solve a linear system using a linear combination of not too many columns from the blue matrix. Okay, now I need to back up and give you some
of the sort of background for abstract sparse approximation problems.
Quick question.
Yeah.
You say you want the small number of variables, you mean in that particular case? Because I can imagine that there are like maybe two linear combinations of those variables, that those are the only things that actually contribute to the model, but like that every one of those variables actually is part of the model, right?
Sorry, could you repeat that?
Well, it could well be the case that, well, just write that same matrix in a different basis, right? There are two linear combinations.
But here's the problem.
Yeah.
In the statistics application, you have the variables that you measure. You don't get to change the basis necessarily.
Okay.
I mean, so you could certainly rotate it or something, but that doesn't really help you.
But it could be that the model only depends, like, for example, if,
sure.
if from either the first or the second test, right? If either the first or second test I got a bad grade, then my final grade would be low, but the rest of the grades don't matter, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then the relevant variable is the sum of the two first grades.
Sure.
Right? So
absolutely.
You have a model which only consists of one variable, which is the sum of the first two grades.
Yeah. Well,
it's very sparse in that basis. Right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the point here is that you're identifying the two variables are actually participating by solving the problem. So if it's really just the first two tests, you want these guys to be non-zero and the rest of them to be zero.
You know, two variables.
For example. I mean, certainly you could glom them all together. I mean, so if you knew the direction that the right hand side were pointing, then you only need one variable. But
if
you could just measure X, then you measure X, right?
It's a different problem to look for a basis in which these things happen.
Yeah. Yeah, well,
okay.
That's a sort of experimental design problem.
Okay.
You know, you're trying to figure out a good way to get acquire information about your.
So can you set up a correlation link or something so you can?
So, I'm sorry, but this is all beside the point. I need to move on. really, this is just motivation. I'm sorry if you're not motivated. the correlation is weak, but positive. All right. So, we need to talk about norms now. I knew I was going to get myself in trouble with this, but I didn't want the first line of the talk to be, let's define the LP norm. Alright, so, the LP norm of vectors defined as the sum of the absolute values of the p to the power to the 1 over p, when 0 is less than p is less than infinity. When p is equal to infinity, it's the maximum absolute value of an entry. And when p is equal to 0, it's defined as the cardinality of the set of non-zero entries of the vector. So, cardinality of set of non-zero entries of the vector, so the size of the support. This is the size of the support of X, and you can also view this as the limit as p goes to 0 of the LP norm to the pth power. So these aren't totally unconnected. Okay. Now, when 1 is less than or equal to p is less than or equal to infinity, this is the LP norm. And when p is between 1 and 0, it's nominal. Not convex, and we'll call this the LP quasi norm. So, in sparse approximation, this L0 quasi norm is really important because what you're trying to do is find sparse solutions to linear systems. So, you want this guy here to have lots of zero entries, so you want its L0 quasi norm to be small. Okay? So that's the connection between these functions here and that problem. And the reason we've got these norms up here is because we need to measure the size of things. So the size of errors, so forth, the magnitude of coefficient vectors, and so on. All right. Now, suppose that A is a linear operator mapping Rm to Rn. We can find the LP operator norm. Is defined as by taking the maximum over all non-zero vectors, applying the operator to the vector, computing the norm of the answer, and dividing by the size of the original vector. Okay? So, just to fix notation here. This is the driest part. It'll be over in just a second. Okay, the reason these operator norms are interesting is that if you want to compute the LP norm of A times a vector X, you can always bound it by the operator norm of the matrix times the vector norm of the vector. Sort of the relevant connection here. And the key examples are that the L2 operator norm is the maximum singular value. The L1 operator norm is the maximum L1 norm of a column. And the infinity operator norm is the maximum L1 norm of a row. Okay. So, any questions on these definitions? If this sort of stuff isn't familiar, we might get in trouble, so. Just wanted to do a make it clear what we're talking about. Alright, so now we come to abstract sparse approximation problems. So, a dictionary for RD is a collection of vectors in RD so that the L2 norm of each vector is equal to 1. So the reason that we insist that all of the vectors have the same norm is so that they're on an equal footing. It's like in the case of the random variables, we want them all to have variance 1. Okay, we don't want any of these vectors to pull more weight than the others. Okay? So we've got a collection of n unit norm vectors in a d-dimensional space, and the vectors are called atoms.
Are we thinking of n as larger or smaller than
We often think about n as larger than d, which is why I write it as a capital letter. It's not necessary. I'm going to give you a little bit more terminology in a second to discuss the cases. Do you have a question, Justin, or just your honor? Okay. I think that's fair. So the elements of this collection are called atoms. And the reason for this has roots and harmonic analysis that are kind of irrelevant to today's lecture. And if the span of this collection is equal to the entire space, the dictionary is complete. So, of course, in that case, n has to be bigger than d. People tend to be interested in the case where dictionaries are complete because you can use them to represent all of the vectors in the space. And if the collection is
linearly independent. Oops, I mean dependent. Sorry, what? Oops, thank you. So if the collection is linearly dependent, the dictionary is redundant. And that doesn't imply anything about the relationship of N and D, but of course, if N is bigger than D, then it has to be redundant, because you can't put more than D linearly independent vectors into a D-dimensional space. Okay, and we'll make a matrix out of these. So we take these vectors, we put them in the columns, and we get a D by N matrix. Okay, so this is sort of the dictionary matrix, and if we multiply this matrix by a vector, we'll get a linear combination of the columns. Okay? So this is sort of a convenient way of synthesizing vectors in the space as a linear combination of the columns of the dictionary, a linear combination of atoms. Okay. On the other hand, if you compute the adjoint or the transpose of the matrix times a vector, and you look at the kth component, this is the inner product between the vector x and the kth column of the matrix. Okay? So the transpose here analyzes the vector x using the columns of the matrix and gives you the inner products. So this is a vector of inner products between the matrix and between the atoms and the distinguished vector x. All right, so let me give you a couple examples of dictionaries. Attack the eraser. So one of the most common examples here is the Dirac Fourier dictionary, and this is designed for analyzing data that is harmonic and impulsive. So it's spiky, and it's also got periodic components. And so the atoms here come into two classes. So the first D of them are spikes. So the components of the kth atom are given by the Kronecker delta. So in other words, it's only equal to 1 in the component where t equals k. Okay, so this vector is 0 everywhere except in the kth component where it's 1. The second batch of atoms is given by complex exponentials, so it's e to the minus 2 pi I kt over d with a normalization. And this is for k equals d plus 1 up to 2d. So these are spikes. These are effectively sinusoids, if you look at the real part. Okay. And the matrix you get from these things is a concatenation of an identity matrix and a discrete Fourier transform matrix. Since I'm a mathematician, the discrete Fourier transform is unitary here, so it's D by D. I'm also aware that these are complex, and we were talking about real stuff a minute ago, but it doesn't really matter. Okay. So this is one of the classical dictionaries that people use to sort of play around with the sparse approximation problem. But there are other dictionaries that people use for applications. So, for example, Fourier plus wavelets is actually more likely to be used for these problems where things are both impulsive and harmonic. People also use Gabor dictionaries for time frequency analysis. And a lot of the time in some of the applications now in physics and astronomy, you'll see people throwing lots of dictionaries, lots of different bases into a bag together so that they can identify a lot of different phenomena in the signal. So you'll wind up with something like curvelet, ridgelet, noiselet, so basically, your imagination is the limit. You can put whatever vectors you want in here. And the idea is that the vectors you're going to put in here are the waveforms that you're trying to break your signal down into. Okay. So in the statistics case, instead of waveforms, you've got random variables. You're trying to write one random variable as a collection, as a linear combination of some other random variables. But in a lot of applications of signal processing, you're trying to break a waveform down into elementary waveforms. Okay. Now, here are the basic sparse approximation problems. You want the sparsest representation of X over the dictionary. So this may not be unique, so I'm going to write, I want a sparsest representation. So this is called a sparse representation. You can also talk about sparse approximation problems if you can't write the vector precisely, or if maybe you want to have a little wiggle room, so you're willing to tolerate some error if it gets you additional sparsity. So there's the error-constrained sparse approximation problem. And in that case, you want to solve minimize the sparsity of the coefficient vector subject to the error in approximation being less than or equal to epsilon. So in statistics terms, this would say, I want a predictor with bias no higher than this, that's as sparse as possible. Again, this solution may not be unique, but so you want a sparsest approximation with error at most epsilon. Okay, and there's one more sort of basic problem. The one usually considered an approximation theory, and that's the sparsity constraint problem. So the sparsity constraint problem says that I want to minimize the approximation error subject to the constraint that I use at most m columns of the matrix. So I want to approximate x using a linear combination of m atoms, m columns of the matrix, and I want the error to be as small as possible. So these are sort of the three basic problems that people look at.
In both cases, you minimize the two because of the bias interpretation?
You can put whatever norm you like on there, but
people don't put 17 norms there.
They often put two norms on there because two norms are a little more analytically tractable. Interpretation in terms of a mean squared prediction error, variance, energy in physics applications. Force of habit. That's actually the reason for the two norms. I mean, there are some good technical reasons, but all right. Now, there's a problem with all of these problems, and that is a theorem due to Natarajan and Davis. Sparse representation is NP hard in general. So what this means is that there is a dictionary and a vector X, so that if you want to solve the sparse representation problem, you must also be able to solve an NP. No one thinks you can do that. So that's bad news.
Not the other two.
They're even worse. So because you can see that the other two problems are generalizations. So if you make m the right size, or you make the error in the other problem the right size, you can get a sparse representation problem. So all of these problems are bad.
What about approximation?
Inapproximable to the linear factor. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I actually don't know how bad the guarantees are. You don't have to ask them to.
No, it's NP complete to approximate to within any factor, either in the approximation error or the number of terms. So it's bad.
It's bad news.
It's really bad.
For the computer scientists, the reductions are to exact cover by three sets or independent set. So they're pretty standard. But this is unfortunate. But let me show you something else. So
is that statement like saying you can't find a needle in a haystack?
Yeah. Yeah, actually. actually, let me give you some intuition. That's a good point. Why is this hard? So the trouble here is that you might have to look at every possible support for the vector C to solve this problem. So if the vector C has n entries, there are 2 to the n subsets of components that could be non-zero. And so you might have to look at all 2 to the n of them in the worst case. That's just the intuition. But there's a combinatorial aspect here because of this counting measure that you put on the support. And it's deadly. So that's the reason. But let's look at this. Suppose phi is orthogonal. So that means that the inverse of the matrix is equal to the transpose. Yeah, I understand. So it also means that the columns of the matrix are form an orthonormal family. Whatever. Here's how you solve the sparse representation problem in this case. Because the matrix is of this form, there's a unique set of coefficients that represents x. You can compute it by multiplying through by the inverse, and the inverse is the transpose. So, in other words, the kth coefficient is just the inner product between x and the kth atom. Okay. And so the approximation of x is equal to formula here. And to solve the other problems is actually not much harder. So if you want to solve the sparsity constraint problem, you just pick out the largest m inner products and throw the rest away. So this is sort of basic Fourier series. Okay. You can think about this as a sort of a generalized Fourier series on a different basis. And you know, you wind up with all of this Bessel and Parseval business going on. But in short, to solve these problems is completely trivial when the matrix is orthogonal. And the next question is, why? All right, see you after coffee.